The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include poor schools can't compete with richer suburban rivals, should they? And mom retaliates after son quits college. And we'll begin with poor schools can't compete. An hour before kickoff at a game this month at Hoover High School, the opposing football team, Indianola High, pulled up and unloaded the large video monitor that would let its coaching staff analyze plays throughout the game. The coaches at Hoover High, where most students qualify for free or reduced-price meals, would have to make do with watching the old-fashioned way. Another loss, a Hoover student told the principal, seemed imminent. Indianola ran 84 yards for a touchdown on its first play, the running back shedding Hoover's smaller players like a video game villain. The game ended in a 35-7 loss for Hoover, to no one's surprise. During the past decade, Hoover High and Des Moines four other large public high schools have a cumulative record of 0-104 against rivals with more affluent student bodies from the Polk County suburbs, according to figures compiled by the Des Moines Register. They rarely do any better against similar opponents from beyond the county like Indianola. The disparity has been the topic of news articles and impassioned conversations across the state from Sioux City to Davenport. With all that losing, leaders in places like Des Moines are contemplating a change in how high school athletic teams are matched up against one another. What if the poverty level of a school student body was used to decide which teams it played? The concept now in use or under consideration in numerous American states and cities turns on its head old notions of athletics as an equalizer. The thought of intentionally lumping poor schools into lesser divisions, separate from richer schools that have fancy equipment and larger and more specialized coaching staffs, rankles some educators who say it sends a terrible message. Our kids don't want to be classified as poor kids who have to play lower-level competition, said Mitchell Moore, a coach at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines. I'm a big believer that socioeconomics has nothing to do with catching football. But at Hoover, where losing has gotten exhausting for players and fans alike, moving down to a lower division would be a welcome relief, many parents and students say. The idea of judging teams based on wealth may sound distasteful in concept, but the reality of losing night after night, year after year, feels far worse. In schools with extra resources for special training and technology, they say simply do better on the field, so why not acknowledge that in the matchups? On just about every Friday night, they outsize us, they outman us, and they outnumber us. Sherry Poole, Hoover's principal, said about the suburban powerhouses on the school schedule that routinely win state championships. Your heart just kind of stops whenever someone gets crunched. Dustin Hagler, a 17-year-old senior who plays on both the offensive and defensive lines for Hoover High, said that he saw students in the hallways who would make good football players, but that they consistently resisted his recruiting efforts. "It's hard when you lose," said Hagler, who is also the senior class president. "But it's not just losing. It's almost like you feel beat down, like the odds are stacked against you." Over the past few years, officials overseeing high school sports in states including Minnesota, Oregon, and Colorado have added provisions allowing schools with high poverty levels to drop down to lower athletic divisions. Washington State will introduce the idea next year, and Iowa is considering it. The debate over whether economic status should have a place in deciding a sport team's competition has been fierce. The issue has led to awkward conversations among school administrators, parents, and teammates, raising questions about fairness and the meaning of high school sports. Supporters say the approach intended to give poorer schools a better chance of winning games will help students gain confidence. They also say it could reduce the risk of concussions and other injuries against teams with more expensive and elaborate training resources and access to better nutrition. "We don't feel like we are coddling these students. We feel like we are trying to put them on an even playing field," said Peter Weber, executive director of the Oregon School Activities Association, which oversees high school athletics. "We need to match kids up with competition that is safe for them so that they can walk out on a field and be competitive." But others, including many coaches, say the changes adds new barriers for impoverished students and suggests that they are too weak or too poor to compete against richer rivals. Why, they ask, should students' athletic potential be limited by their parents' bank accounts? And some opponents say tinkering with long-standing athletic matchups in an attempt to even the odds is a way of babying young people, a medals-for-everyone mentality that undermines lessons in resilience and grit. "They are out there making do with what they have, and that's the right thing to do," said Gabe Murray, 19, a former Hoover football player. Tom Ferry, executive director of the Aspen Institute's Sports and Society Program, said the sports achievement disparity between wealthy suburban public schools and their urban counterparts has degenerated into a competitive gap that is similar to the income gap in the nation. "The divide has always been there," he said, "but it has widened." The disparity, experts say, is meaningful among the world of athletics because sports participation has been found to aid in academic success and college admissions and is a predictor for professional success. The discussion comes at a critical juncture for youth sports, where participation rates for many activities, particularly football, are in decline because of fears about brain injury and because children's interests more than ever fall outside engagement in traditional sports, according to studies. For the moment, switching leagues is not yet an option in Iowa, where the Iowa High School Athletic Association is scheduled to discuss the issue later this year. If a request by the Des Moines Public Schools and other districts is approved, Hoover and other schools could apply to drop down a division. And next, from Carolyn Hax's column, "Mom Retaliates After Son Quits College." And we have a letter from a reader. "Dear Carolyn, my 19-year-old son, who just graduated high school, has suddenly decided he doesn't want to go to college. He wants to sweat and work hard, learning the electrical trade his father does for a living. He worked hard in high school and was accepted into an elite healthcare program. After two classes, he told me his heart isn't there anymore. It has been hard for me to accept because he is so smart and could do anything. He says he is an adult now. He wants to make adult decisions and make his own money. Okay, I understand that, but it doesn't help that his girlfriend is always telling him he doesn't make his own decisions and I'm controlling. Yes, I am controlling. I love him and didn't want to see him make the same mistakes I did. I set aside going back to school so I could help support his dreams. My husband says I'm just mad he quit college. Am I asking too much or just being a controlling mother? And this is Carolyn's answer. Dear controlling, maybe both. I can't tell from here. They're not mutually exclusive. But I'm with your husband. I see a mom lashing out at the son she thinks let her down. And my problems with that are, number one, it's not about you. You made sacrifices, yes, but those never buy parents a specific outcome. It was and will always be the child's life to live. It's prejudicial and unfair. A trade is not a disappointment relative to college, not if your goal is to raise loving, independent-minded, productive citizens who are comfortable in their own skin. A kid can become all of those things on the college track, vocational track, military track, track and field track, make it up as you go track, and anything includes anything. Please tell me you've taken a breath by now and have recognized this. And thirdly, it's not effective. Punishing him for his choices, emotionally, financially, however else, is not the path to a college-educated son. More likely, it's a path to estrangement from your defiantly closing his mind to other options son, since that's how kids, even grown ones, tend to react to being judged. Be flexible, and he might hear advice to take a year to earn money and think a bit, since quitting can be a good or bad decision, but haste is rarely good. Keep being rigid, though, and he might never forget your contempt for his judgment and possibly eventual profession. Ouch. And next, poll, energy-saving habits vary in popularity. Turn off the lights when they aren't needed? Check. Lower the thermostat a few degrees in winter? Maybe. Go full-time vegetarian? Probably not. Americans are willing to go only so far in engaging in habits that conserve energy and reduce emissions that are warming the planet. According to a new poll by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, the poll adds to research showing that many take modest steps they consider convenient and feasible and good for their pocketbooks. But actions that would involve significant lifestyle choices such as diet or transportation are a tougher sell. Roughly 9 in 10 Americans say they often or always turn off unnecessary lights, including 6 in 10 who do so all the time. About half often or always set the thermostat at 68 degrees or lower in winter to reduce heating, while slightly fewer say they keep summertime air conditioning temperatures at 76 degrees or higher. It has to be pitch dark outside for me to turn a light on, said sandwich shop worker Tay Harris, 25, of Terre Haute, Indiana, who said she wants to help with climate change and considers it common sense to save electricity. If you have the beautiful sun that God blessed us with, use it. The poll found about 2 in 10 Americans often or always use public transportation, carpool, bike, or walk instead of driving, while nearly 3 in 10 do so some of the time. Similarly, while only 5% 12% say they always eat vegetarian meals. Another 13% said they do so, and 37% said they sometimes do. Meat production contributes to global warming in numerous ways, scientists say. It generates manure that releases methane to the atmosphere and encourages destruction of forests that store carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas, to clear land for pasture and livestock feed crops. Overall, 14% said they frequently plant trees. About 6 in 10 city dwellers said they rarely or never plant trees, as opposed to about half of those living elsewhere. The APNORC poll of 1,058 adults was conducted August 15 through 18. The margin of sampling error for respondents is plus or minus 4.2 percentage points. Climate concern isn't the only reason Americans conserve energy. Previous research by the APNORC Center suggests another motive is saving money. The latest survey conducted last month shows that some people who don't believe in climate change routinely take actions such as turning off lights and limiting use of heat and air conditioning. So do many who acknowledge the planet is warming, but think it's happening naturally. Americans with college degrees were more likely than those without them to say they always or often set the thermostat lower in winter and higher in summer, as well as eat vegetarian meals. And next, from the Triangle Business Journal, the executive voice, and this time it's Anna Lynch. She builds her firm by pushing her boundaries. Anna Lynch leads her own engineering firm, Lynch Mikens, and is guiding it through a period of rapid growth in one of the fastest-growing real estate markets in the country. It's a big change from the life she once thought she wanted. Growing up in a family of entrepreneurs in Iowa, Lynch saw the ups and downs that come with owning businesses, with the potential for heartache and anxiety. "I decided I needed some stability," Lynch said. However, she didn't want to be a lawyer, I don't like reading, or a doctor, I don't like blood. So she set off to build a career in math and science, studying structural engineering at the University of Wyoming. After school, she decided to look for work somewhere warmer and headed to the southeast. Among those earlier applications was a structural engineering firm, Stroud, Pence, and Associates. They said, "I'm not hiring," and I said, "Why don't I take you out to lunch?" Lynch recalls. "We just hung out for an hour, and I remember leaving and saying, 'I'd love to work for them.' He said, 'We're not hiring.' And a week later, he called and offered me the job." That was in 2003. 16 years later, Lynch is now the CEO and owns the firm with her business partner, Dave Mikens. They bought the company in 2017, renamed it Lynch Mikens, and moved the headquarters from Virginia Beach, Virginia, to Raleigh, where Lynch is based. And they've grown the company from about 30 employees to 40 and are looking to expand to a bigger space soon. "It's been crazy amazing," Lynch said. "I feel like we're just happy and we have a blast together." And as the office has grown, so has the base of projects, including the One Glenwood's sister tower project at the intersection of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street. Lynch also has clients around the country. She credits her firm's success with its engineering experience and the importance they place on people skills. "When I bought the company, my whole business plan was engineers with communication skills," Lynch said. "Yes, we're great structural engineers, but clients also want the value we bring in soft skills, which are really hard to train. That means her staff is comfortable discussing their role on a project in conference calls and meetings. We focus on, yes, we're structural engineers, but we're project managers and leaders in the industry, Lynch says. She realized the importance of this while working on a project with Lenovo in Research Triangle Park. There, Lynch was expected to present her plans in a large room with each of the companies involved in the project. She found she succeeded in that collaborative environment, opening the door to new opportunities and larger contracts. My reputation changed after that, she said. On top of this, the firm works to stay up to speed on technology as traditional modeling software sees new and exciting upgrades. With BIM and Revit, for example, architects, engineers, and clients can envision projects in the same virtual space. Architects are in there building what the building looks like, and contractors and owners can walk through the building, and we're all in there together, she says. There are so many things constantly being invented, and we spend so much time doing research on that. Now, as the company CEO, Lynch says the search for stability plays a smaller part in her life, as she's found herself to be a natural leader and risk taker. Engineers don't like risk in general, and they don't like change. I love risk and change, so I'm constantly changing, she said. I'm uncomfortable being comfortable. With this mindset, she set about pushing her firm to grow. Lynch Mikan sees about 10 to 20% growth each year, she says, and revenue has shot up 33% since 2017. And she says she has no plans for slowing down. We want to be the biggest structural engineering firm in the United States, Lynch said. And next, Tom Cruise feels the need for speed from a jet made in North Carolina. Since its first Honda jet went wheels up in 2017, Greensboro-based Honda Aircraft Company has quickly made a name for itself in aviation circles around the world, with some 130 Honda Jet and Honda Jet Elite models in service, both by private ownership and boutique airlines. And now the Honda Motor Company subsidiaries nearly $5 million uniquely above wing-mounted product has at least one celebrity owner. The BizJet's 101 page on Instagram features a photo of a new Honda Jet Elite taking off from Biggin Hill Airport near London, piloted by its owner, actor Tom Cruise. Registered with the Federal Aviation Administration under tail number N77VA, the plane's owner is listed as Hijo LLC of Los Angeles. Records show it was delivered for service on June 6. The action film star of Top Gun and its forthcoming sequel is a licensed pilot, and the new Honda Jet is only the latest in his aircraft collection. Although Honda aircraft officials are mum about the sale, it is known that before a pilot can fly a Honda Jet, he or she must first personally undergo training in a flight simulator located on the Honda aircraft campus at Piedmont Triad International Airport. Also on the campus is an aircraft delivery center, where a new jet awaits its owner on a rotating steel turntable in the center of the room filled with dramatic music, complete with a glass elevator that allows the plane to be viewed from above. The owner is then handed the keys, the hangar bay doors open, the plane is towed to the tarmac, and then takes off from a PTI runway. Given that Honda Jet is the fastest in the less than 12,500-pound category, it's only fitting that it all appeals to a maverick with a need for speed. And next, a Charlotte sports bar owes $237,000 in taxes. A Charlotte sports bar owes $237,000 in unpaid taxes, according to federal public records. A federal tax lien was filed against Sports One Charlotte LLC in August. That sports bar and lounge is located at 521 North College Street in the downtown region of the city. Sports One owes quarterly unemployment and payroll taxes dating from December 2016 to December 2017, according to the filing. The total amount due is $236,952.51. Attempts to reach the Sports One owners were unsuccessful. A sign on the door says the business is closed for renovations. A phone number for the business appears disconnected, though a website is active. An emailed request for comment and Facebook message went unanswered. The NC Secretary of State dissolved the limited liability company in February 2018 for failure to file an annual report. And now back to the News and Observer. Quid pro quo is Latin, but Trump made it easy to understand. President Trump and his defenders in the ongoing impeachment inquiry are pretending that the law is more complicated than it is. Quid pro quo is Latin for one thing for another. Trump has argued that he did nothing wrong during his phone call with the president of Ukraine last summer because there was no quid pro quo, no explicit request of continued aid for Ukraine for an investigation of Joe Biden, his leading opponent in the next election. A quid pro quo is not essential to a crime or abuse of power. But the president is wrong in any event. No magic words are required for a quid pro quo to take place. If I withhold something your country needs to survive, like money to buy missiles to defend against Russian attacks, and I ask you for a favor, that is quid pro quo. Neither the law nor common sense require me to say, or else. If it did, corruption and extortion would be almost impossible to prove because mobsters and crooked politicians would simply avoid making explicit threats. Imagine that people are being laid off at your workplace. Your boss calls and refers to the fact that you have not been let go. You say that you really appreciate still having a job. He then says, "I need a favor, though," which are the exact words the president used. You are listening very carefully to your boss's every word because your economic survival depends on keeping him happy. When you hear the words, "I need a favor, though," you will believe that the favor is a condition for not being laid off because "though" can only refer to what you just said about still having a job. Now imagine that the favor your boss asks is something wrongful. He asks you to go on a date with him. Well, that would certainly be a problem, wouldn't it? We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it and be sure to listen the next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.